The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. A lot of interesting things that are going on around the world. We definitely want to talk about them today. As we usually do on Fed Access, we always like to cover what's going on with national security, kind of homeland security, intelligence issues, terrorism issues, and everything else. And one of our favorite experts is on the line with me, Fred Burton from Stratfor. They're a geopolitical private intelligence firm that provides a number of resources, intelligence gathering and analysis and forecasting for private companies, for NGOs, for government agencies, but they stay abreast of all the different things that's going on around the world. As we've all been watching out there, the Paris attacks have happened recently. These are attacks that were horrific, but you know, many have kind of said, hey, listen, this is something that has been predicted. These terrorist cells, these cells that are going around in different countries and possibly even in our own homeland. We want to try to find out what's going on and what is the impact of Paris, not only to our international interests, but right here in America. Do we need to have any kind of concerns? Fred Burton is Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. And Fred, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Derek, as always.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Fred, you know, and I saw you making the rounds and on everything else, and you were providing some good insight. Break the Paris situation down for us in terms of the impact to the United States. I mean, they went out, attacked police officers. They went out, attacked media outlets. They went out and really tried to cause people to, you know, really stop free speech. What's the impact for us?
Well, their target selection was simply brilliant. In essence, there was brilliance and simplicity, and obviously they had conducted a tremendous amount of pre-operational surveillance. It's our understanding that they had surveilled the attack site, the initial attack site, for several weeks, which you and I understand this phenomenon. You have police presence at this location. The French knew that this site had been threatened in the past. It had been burned to the ground in the past, and yet the terrorist team had factored in killing the cops before they went in to kill the targeted individuals. And once inside the magazine, they actually specifically identified persons to assassinate inside the venue. So this was a well-thought-out plan. Now, the curious part to me, Derek, as we broke down the videotape here, is as you look at this, as they're leaving the scene, the younger shooter seems to be a little bit discombobulated. For example, he had difficult time trying to make a magazine change with his weapon. The older brother changed the magazine for him. And then they went and attacked another uniformed police car that was responding to them. So this was a very violent and purposeful kind of activity. And I think the other phenomena here, when you start looking at this in context with the secondary attack at the kosher market, was there you have your classic soft target location where it appears that Jews specifically were identified and Jewish targets were destined to be what they wanted to hit. And I know this has caused a tremendous amount of problems and angst in the Jewish community throughout Europe, but especially in France and in Brussels. It wasn't that long ago, I believe it was May, that you had the individual walk into the Jewish Museum in Brussels and carry out a similar kind of commando-style attack. So this is a phenomenon that the European services have got their hands full to get their arms around. Now, what does this mean to us here? I think the Muslim community here in the United States is better integrated into society at large. Therefore, I don't think we have that same degree of radicalized problem here. But what we do have here, as evidenced by previous attacks that we've seen, are the, again, the lone actor variant that individual that might watch this unfold in Europe and feels compelled to walk into a Jewish cultural center or a Jewish day school here in the United States and try to do the same thing.
You know, as we think about this, Fred, and that's the kind of the troubling dynamic of, you know, people, a copycat scenario. Are these sales, are they getting, and it may be hard for us to tell, are they getting kind of command and control from, and, you know, it kind of reminds me of the taxi in Mumbai and other things like that, where they were getting command and control from somebody, or, you know, when they go overseas, are they kind of getting orders to say, do A, B, C, and D, or they just may get training and then say, you go out and pick your own targets, and you go out and, you know, you do the kind of surveillance and you do what you think is best. What is the command and control of these kind of sales, or are they just kind of independently lone wolf and just kind of picking out what they want to do?
It's a tad bit of a hybrid model. It appears that the older brother did spend some time, for example, in Yemen, where not a lot of time, 2 or 3 days of visiting and receiving some form of instruction. And not your traditional kind of terrorist training camp. And, of course, they were known to the French services, which is another challenge. I think, just based on my research here, pretty much every one of these shooters that have ever been involved in an attack, to include the Boston Marathon bombing, were well known to law enforcement. So, of course, you have to ask those kinds of tough questions. Now, you and I know how this happens. You have so many different suspects, specifically in Europe. You have a fixed number of assets to try to investigate on a live threat matrix on a daily basis, trying to monitor the comings and goings with porous borders, and there lies the challenge. And it's probably the kind of challenge that I hearken back to that we saw, for example, in the 70s with the Black September organization and the PFLP and the Abu Nidal organization and the Italian Red Brigades and the Red Army faction running all around Europe, utilizing the porous borders, safe havens, different passports to try to hunker down and carry out these kinds of attacks.
You know, when you think about it and kind of, you know, as we think about where this is going, are we concerned, Fred? And like you said, law enforcement have been monitoring these guys, the same situation in Boston. Are we concerned that, and a lot of the, even at the media outlets, I know for all the media outlets have all gotten kind of warnings to be careful and everything else. Are we concerned that a similar kind of attack will happen here? I mean, is that the major concern that you're hearing from private companies, from, you know, law enforcement agencies, that we have these sales here? We saw it in Boston, but are people still concerned that this thing may happen in a D.C., a New York, a Chicago, or anywhere else, you know, Austin, anywhere else, that this kind of attack can be replicated or even made more damaging?
I think there is concern. I think that if you look at this from the FBI, DHS, big city law enforcement perspective, for example, in Washington, D.C., this is frightening. These are the kinds of things that when you have bad guys, terrorists, that are purposefully targeting the cops to kill first before they carry out their mission, that's the kind of also scenario we saw in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing plot threats that surfaced after the first World Trade Center bombing, where Al-Qaeda had very elaborate plans to kill Secret Service and State Department agents assigned to different protection details, that, for example, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, knowing that you had to kill the agents and the cops first, and then you could kill who you wanted to kill. And when you have that kind of mindset, you know, from a law enforcement and a military perspective, as much as we like to think about this, and I'm a former cop and a former agent, I get it. The last thing you're thinking about in any given day, especially on a protection detail, or a fixed post protection detail like you have throughout Washington, D.C. with the U.S. Secret Service Uniform Division, and in New York with NYPD standing at various diplomatic facilities, I guarantee you that's the kind of threat that we saw unfold in Paris that should wake up everybody doing that kind of fixed post protection and police coverage of all these facilities.
You know, with that being said, and Fred, I want to cover it as we go to the next break. you know, my concern is, and I think, I don't know what you heard about Paris, that people had seen this. I mean, somebody, the neighbors were suspicious, and like they said, these guys were under surveillance. You know, how do we deal with this ever-growing threat? And a lot of people don't understand that to do a surveillance detail, and you know from your days, Fred, to do surveillance, that's just a lot of resources that go into surveilling one or two people. You have to have, you know, 10, 20, 30 people to do around-the-clock surveillance. You know, how do we get around this kind of situation without damaging our liberties and everything else? Because I think that is the concern when we have known suspects who end up doing something. And people are like, well, why isn't this person in jail? Let's talk about that when we come back. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. They have a lot of different great services, a number of different subscriptions you can get, but they provide intelligence services for private companies, the Fortune 500, medium-sized companies, small companies, anybody, government agencies, nonprofit, NGOs. They provide a number of different services for everybody out there, and you can get their intelligence, their forecasting, their risk analysis, and a number of different things that'll be helpful. We'll be right back after this break. We're talking about the terrorist threat. We're talking about the impact to the homeland. We're talking about what can be done about this as we're into 2015, and we're dealing with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and a number of different threats out there. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the terrorist threat. We saw this situation in Paris unfold, a tragic situation against a news outlet, against a magazine, and a situation where people were very, very afraid that they were going to be attacked. Where we had the store attacked, we had cops attacked, we had a number of different people who were attacked by a small group of terrorists who had the intent of really kind of traumatizing France and Europe. And this thing has grown all over to everywhere, not only to France, but to Greece and a number of other European areas. And these people have traveled over to Yemen, to Syria, and we're trying to figure out what's going on and what's the impact to not only our international interests, but our homeland interests. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com, a great organization to get some insight and analysis on all the different international events that are out there. Fred, you know, going back to this dynamic, from what I heard on the media outlets, and maybe you heard something, we had an older couple who really were suspicious about these people, were concerned about them. They found some stuff, but they were told to not say something. They were concerned about their lives. They had surveillance on these guys. A number of different intelligence services were watching them at some point in time. We're still dealing with a situation that we know certain people, but then they end up doing something. How do we get past this?
Derek, every terrorist attack that I've ever investigated that has been successful boils down to two failure points, and it really is that simple. The first is a lack of human intelligence, meaning you don't have the penetration into that group, that specific cell, so you know exactly what they're up to. Mm-hmm. And that penetration is best with human, but it also could be augmented by ELINT, SIGINT, other kinds of surveillance activity, but predominantly human intelligence. The second failure point is the lack of tactical analysis, meaning you have collected the info, you have collected the threat, you have put it into a matrix and a threat assessment, like what was done with these suspects of being of record. But there's a breakdown in the tactical analysis, and it's really very similar to the fact that if you lack the human intelligence, you really can't connect the dots from the tactical analysis. So both of those have to be in sync in order to prevent an attack from occurring. And if you look at the wonderful job that the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Forces have done, for the most part, throughout the United States, they've been successful in carrying out both of those. You know, they've got good human intelligence on people. They have picked them off, and they have introduced undercovers. They have neutralized plots, so they know who to surveil. Now, in fairness and in complete disclosure, the FBI has simply less of those kinds of suspects to surveil here than the Europeans do,
right.
And that's the challenge. And then think of this in concept with all the different multiple police and federal government agencies today and the DHS fusion centers and the task force, and just look around the Washington, D.C. area on jurisdiction. and think in concept for your listeners of all the different police services in Europe and trying to get the French to cooperate with the Germans, to cooperate with the Belgians, to cooperate with the Norwegians. This is the kind of challenge that we saw, again, going back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, when we had people such as Abu Nidal transiting and living in France, and we couldn't get anybody to do anything about it. We had senior Hezbollah officials, R&R, there in Europe, and we couldn't get anybody to do anything about it. So it becomes a real challenge diplomatically, law enforcement liaison-wise, intelligence service liaison-wise, to try to get in front of these issues. And so far, the scorecard in Europe is not good.
You know, as we look at it, can this be, and of course we have to get more human and in that dynamic, as we both know, Fred, a lot of the human had been cut back for many years, and then, you know, they had the ebb and flow, and sometimes you have strong human operations and then sometimes you'll scale back on those things. You know, it seems as if this is still a growing problem, that because human takes a long time to develop, you know, in order to actually penetrate an organization. You know, do you think that the governments, including our own, are putting enough into that? I mean, you can, like you said, you can only do surveillance for so much, but if you don't have somebody inside, you know, finding out the date of an attack or what's going on, you can watch somebody all day, but they could slip you and then still do something and then cause a whole bunch of harm. Are people putting the resources, federal agencies and international agencies, are they putting the right resources into human?
Oh, I think so. I think in the continental United States, yes. I think the FBI has transformed their agency. You know, it's still trying to move the 1,000-pound gorilla in the battleship, so to speak, but they are much more nimbler when it comes to this today. You have a very good CIA globally that is very capable of doing this. But you have to deal down into jurisdictional issues, sovereignty issues, getting governments and nation states to help surveil suspects on cross-border operations, the border issues, the foreign fighters fleeing back into Europe from the battlefield. And if you think in concept of how do you police that, and how do you keep tabs on the people that have left, and how do you keep tabs on the people that are coming back, and let's say someone is from Algeria but got family in France, and they have traveled to Algeria and then they've slipped off to the battlefield and they come back 3, 4, 5 months later. Do we really have a good handle on them as they move from Algeria to the battle space then back and forth? That's the kind of problem that the European services are confronted with, and it's a daunting challenge. I can't think of a worse job to be in than in the counterterrorism arena in some of the European services at this moment.
And you, just like you mentioned, I mean, this the number of different, and they're even getting intelligence from not only their counterparts in Europe, but they're also, from what we understand, getting intelligence from our national security agencies, from the CIA, from NSA, and everyone like that, our FBI. They're all trying to work together. It seems as if this dynamic of information sharing, although it's been improved, it's almost a problem that, and you know, unless we actually violate the rights of people, it is going to be just a tough thing. On the private side, Fred, I want to kind of make sure we discuss this, you know, kind of as we come back. On the private side, is there something that private companies can do? Is there something that can be done in terms of corporations, in terms of trying to figure out who are working, you know, who's working for them, to say, hey, I think something's wrong with this person. You guys need to check them out. You know, are there other things that just the public can do in order to kind of maybe stop this stuff? And is it a matter that we need to secure our facilities better? I don't know. I mean, you know, do we need to have better security, more that round 24/7, 365 security? You know, what can it be? What can be done? And I want to talk about that when we come back, Fred. What can be done to help maybe thwart this threat of terrorist attacks around not only Europe, but also in, because you've dealt with that dynamic of protecting people, but also in the homeland? We're talking to Fred Burton. He's vice president of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com. They're a great organization, a number of different analyses. You can definitely get some insight on a number of different things internationally by looking at their site and getting their services. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what's going on with terrorism. We're talking about the Paris attacks. We're talking about the impact of Paris. We're talking about the impact of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all these things on our interests, not only abroad, but also in the United States. And we're talking about what can we do to maybe prevent these kind of attacks. We don't want to have a Paris attack here. We don't want to have another Boston here. We don't want to have another 9/11 here. What can we do? Things have improved. But as we see that this is still a serious issue that's out there, we're talking to Fred Burton. He's Vice President of Intelligence for Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com, an international geopolitical intelligence service providing a number of different resources for government agencies, nonprofits, and also the private sector. Fred, you know, in your work at State Department, when you used to work at diplomatic security and doing other things, and your work at Stratfor, you know, as you kind of consult with different people about how, because I'm sure you're getting those questions all the time, about how can we secure ourselves? I mean, I think we all have to know, and everybody has to understand, the government can't do everything. The government just does not have the resources to do every single thing. What are you advising to, you know, people to say, how do you help maybe stop this thing?
Well, first, you have to take ownership of the problem and recognize exactly what you said, that the government at times is not going to be able to help you. Granted, they will get resources to you as quickly as possible. But if you look at this facility that was first attacked in Paris, you had fixed-post police coverage. You had surveillance of the location. It had been burned down before. It had been threatened because of the Mohammed, the cartoon drawings. So it's easy to sit back and say, what more could be done? We're all brilliant after the fact, and hindsight's always 20/20. Now, it would have been good, I think, if that facility had had a safe haven inside for employees to retreat to,
right?
Perhaps panic buttons with an audible alarm that you had an active shooter, train for active shooter scenarios, make sure that people know to take this seriously, and when the alarm goes off, to move and to move quickly. Now, for all I know, those things had been done, but something tells me that I don't think so. And I think that's the problem. Most companies very rarely train. They very rarely have safe havens. They very rarely conduct drills. They very rarely have active shooter plans in place. So those are the kinds of things that companies and even people can take ownership of, and that's the kind of advice that when people came to us after Paris saying, what should we do, we made sure that they went over those kinds of things. And if you have been threatened or shown up on these Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula or Inspire magazine hit lists, you really do need to take that seriously. And that takes it and ratchets it to another level. So, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Go to the Metropolitan Police Department, which is quite good, and say, hey, can you do a security survey of our facility? Where are we weak? Where should we shore things up? How should we get things done? They'll help you. Ask the FBI for help. Go to your local police, if you're a business, and look at these. You see, one of the interesting dynamics that you have in D.C., Derek, is this. With all the hard targets in D.C., granted high-value targets, in many ways that's pushed the threat onto the softer areas, into the softer targets, mm-hmm. into the tourist areas, into those other government buildings, some of which are involved in government contracting, sometimes classified government contracting, just in and around the Beltway. There's thousands of these buildings. So in essence, with that, security needs to be first and foremost in everybody's mind.
You know, you just hit upon a really, really important point, Fred, in terms of people probably not taking things serious enough. I mean, you know, we see these attacks, and it's almost, are you kind of getting a sense that people kind of think it won't happen to us? I mean, you know, even if they are on a hit list or they're mentioned, they kind of think, you know, hey, they're talking, or they're just kind of bluffing, and people think it won't happen to me. And then until that does happen to you, but then that's hindsight 2020, and then it's too late because either you're dead or your organization's been attacked or whatever the case is. What you're saying right now is that if you, you know, even sense that you're in their kind of the target list or the kill zone of these people or mention, or you're a type of organization that is a soft target that they may want to attack or whatever the case is, you need to take this threat very, very serious. Is that what I'm hearing you saying, Fred?
Yes, I think it begins with situational awareness. It begins with some basic security practices, active shooter training, situational training for this is what's going to happen when God forbid, we have an event unfold in our facility. I think there's been enough examples of that from the Army Navy shooting yard incident to Fort Hood with Major Hassan,
right,
to Boston, to take these kinds of problems today very, very seriously. And from a liability perspective, if you're responsible for people in buildings, you should let that kind of knowledge and program go forward and get help from local law enforcement or federal authorities and take advantage of all the wonderful free guidance that you can get from the DHS and the FBI and the DC police and your surrounding jurisdictions that would love to walk through your space, and so they get a chance to eyeball it too from a tactical purpose.
Right.
So again, if worst case scenario unfolds, they've been through and walked through that area.
And sometimes even a matter of providing blueprints to your building to, you know, the DC police or the FBI, so that just in case something does happen, that, you know, their response time can be better. They can get into the facility better. They know how, you know, they know who has the keys to certain places. They know how to, you know, operate within this zone. Is that right, Fred? I mean, trying, you know, really kind of providing that information to help people help you?
Absolutely. And know that your expensive surveillance cameras can be used to your benefit. Tactically, it can be used. If you do have a problem in your facility, how do I get access to that?
Mm-hmm.
Is there remote capabilities and so forth? Those are the kinds of things that organizations I don't see a lot of companies at times taking advantage of those kinds of free resources. And let me say this. You guys in the city, in the D.C. area, much like New York, are miles ahead, even though some may not think so, than others as you go west. We're located in Austin, Texas. This is very much a proximity issue, awareness, meaning the farther and farther you go west and south of the Northeast Corridor, the less and less businesses are prepared for this kind of activity.
Hmm. Does that mean that the threat matrix for areas that are, you know, of course, where you do have a city who is, you know, very, very much aware, do you think that the target dynamic is going to change sometime to say, listen, we're going to take this to a whole other city because they don't have the same kind of awareness about terrorism and everything else? Do you think that that may happen in the future?
I do. I think that you look at this as, you know, pushing the threat onto the soft target based on the upgrades and security of your high-value targets, such as the White House, the Pentagon, Andrews Air Force Base, the State Department, the CIA. And so you start looking around if you're that inspiring terrorist. I mean, look, I remember the day that Miramal Kanzi walked up to the front gate of the CIA and started shooting employees going to work that morning. In essence, it would be difficult to do that again today.
Right.
But you could pick all kinds of very similar other sites around the Beltway a little farther out, or you can expand your geography and move that kind of operation into places like Philadelphia, for example, or any other major city as you push west or south, and the chances of you being successful are pretty darn good.
Right, Right, right. Fred, I want to talk about, because you mentioned about surveillance, and I want to kind of talk about is, you know, for people to think about this, especially, you know, private companies, everything else, they're picking targets, whether and they're using social media, they're using certain surveillance tools, they're using out things that are out there to find out as much information as possible. They had a target list, as you mentioned, of people who they had already watched, and they knew who they were going for when they went into this building, which is very, very frightening. They didn't just go kill everybody. They killed specific people. I want to talk about maybe how a person can make sure that, you know, they are looking at that counter surveillance, make sure that if they are being watched, they see that, they know that, make sure that if their building's being watched, they can kind of see those things happening. What should they do? I want to talk about when they come back, when we come back. We're talking to Fred Burton. He is the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. Great organization providing insight, analysis, intelligence on a number of issues. Terrorism is one of them, but all over the world, they are looking at things and forecasting risk assessments and just looking at the threat out there and talking to different people about how you deal with these different situations. How do you operate successfully in crisis environments? We'll be right back. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the terrorist situation. What's going on? We've seen the attacks in Paris, but it leaves us to be concerned about everything, about what's going on here. We've had attacks, you know, within the past couple of years here as well that were kind of similar, Boston and other areas. We wonder, can this happen again in the United States? We wonder, can this happen again against Americans overseas? We wonder, can anybody stop these threats from, whether it be ISIS, Al-Qaeda, a lone wolf scenario, or whatever the case is, how do we prevent these things? We're talking to Fred Burton. He's the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. But they provide a number of different resources and analysis on a number of different threats and situations around the world. Fred, when we look at kind of surveillance and we talk about kind of operational or pre-operational surveillance, how can one know and how can one kind of maybe see if somebody is surveilling them? And then also, what are your thoughts about social media? Should people begin to downscale their presence and how much information that they have about themselves on social media?
Well, your latter question first. I do think so. I know that there's been some recent concerns shared within the intelligence community of military and law enforcement personnel where you could have individuals hostile or desirous of pinpointing employees surfing these kinds of websites to see who's out there and where they live and things like that. I mean, this gets back to just good personal observation, personal operational security, where you take ownership of that and think about the photos that you're posting, as well as think about what you have on there that could be used against you if somebody wanted to look for that. And it's the same kind of thing that happens with your criminal elements, looking at the family that is vacationing with pictures from Hawaii, and therefore their home is left unguarded at home, so your average burglar knows that there's going to be nobody home to go that day when they decide to go in and kick in your back door. So these kinds of phenomena, you know, do exist, and in our digital age like this, people do need to be aware of that. And I know it's a double-edged sword. It's generational, it's cultural, and people like to post these kinds of things, family and friends, and at times it's very difficult to control family and friends from posting various things and so forth, but it's something that really people do need to think about.
Right, right. And, you know, with all of that, if a person is being kind of watched or a building is being watched, are there any kind of key signs that people should be aware of that, you know, somebody may be kind of watching your facility or watching you?
Yes. It gets back to situational awareness, having your head on a swivel, making sure that as you're coming and going from work, whether it's by foot or vehicle, that you're checking your mirrors. You don't have your head buried in your iPhone or your BlackBerry walking down the street. You don't know what's happening around you. It's that kind of basic awareness. And you know, I challenge your listeners to go out and look around them today on the streets of Washington on a sunny day and look how many people are just not paying attention. And those kinds of persons will never see what's happening around them, from witnesses to crime or being a victim of a crime or whatever. So some basic situational awareness goes a long way. And as DHS says, if you see something, say something. The system is designed today to very rapidly engage and rule something in or out very quickly.
Right.
And I think, again, the D.C. environment is a high-threat environment, so I think people are traditionally more aware. But it's still shocking to me every time I'm there how many folks aren't. And that's one of the big issues. When it comes to surveillance on facilities and so forth, there's wonderful technology and surveillance technology that can assist, and pretty much every building that I'm in or out of anymore, regardless around the country, you do have good perimeter security that's in place when it comes to surveillance footage. But at times, that will only help you reconstruct things once the event has occurred.
Right.
You know, it's very good for investigative purposes, but it's not going to stop that attack from unfolding.
You need people actively looking at things and kind of taking a look to see if, you know, suspicious people, suspicious activity, they may be acting like a tourist, but are they doing something a little bit more? Did they come back several times or things like that? You know, Fred, I want to talk about, you know, before we go, we only got a few minutes, but, you know, you always stand abreast of Mexico, and me and you always talk about this as an issue that's not in the news, but it's so critical. What's going on? What's your situational awareness right now about the status in Mexico and you know, issues that are going across with the border wars, the cartels, and everything else?
It's business as usual, Derek. Unfortunately, it doesn't get a lot of national news coverage, which is part of the strategy with the Mexican government, the less press on this issue, the better. Press surrounding this issue is also bad for the cartels. So the cartels have pretty much driven all the newspapers and journalists out of Mexico, so there's not a lot of reporting at times. It's interesting you ask. We just did our Mexico quarterly call yesterday, where did our wrap-up for all of our subscribers and clients focused on Mexico. And the amount of ebbing and flowing is constant, depending upon where you are in the country. I would encourage your listeners to check out our website to take a look. We've got some very good graphics on the website that will show you quickly where you're traveling to in Mexico, to include the tourist areas,
mm-hmm.
which areas are controlled by which cartel, because there is, in every place you go, going to be a specific cartel that controls the geography of where you're traveling to, either for business or pleasure. And that map has shown up in countless government reports and so forth. That's a very good and quick tool. The one fascinating aspect, Derek, and I'll leave you with this thought, is this. The working agents that are engaged in drug interdiction on the border estimate that they're only interdicting or seizing 1-2% of all drugs flowing in the United States.
Wow. Wow, that's startling. That's startling.
Think of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, that leaves the question, and you know, and because we've been dealing with this situation for such a long time. Some people think that the legalization of drugs is going to be the idea. I don't know, you know, if we're only getting 1-2% of all drugs that are coming out. Of course, the economics of demand are driving this business for these drugs to kind of come into our area. You know, is anyone coming up with any kind of new solutions? Because, I mean, you know, we keep on dealing with this border situation, and it doesn't seem, even with technology, we can put the drones out there and everything else. But it seems as if they're always finding new ways to get through here.
They certainly are, with new and novel ideas. For example, China White heroin is coming across. It's called China White, but it's actually manufactured by Mexican cartels, and it's coming to the United States. There has been a slight decrease of cocaine, but marijuana is flowing in bundles, despite some of the legalization issues in certain states around the country. crystal meth is just flowing daily. And if you think of this, and I, after mulling this over all night, basically, that our war on drugs has been, what, 40 years?
At least.
And if we're only interdicting on a practical level that amount, certainly the strategy is just not working.
Right.
So there has to be smarter ways of doing this. And, you know, I don't know what that answer is.
Right.
I've been in a lot of symposiums and panels where some of the great thinkers on this topic believe that we almost need like a Manhattan Project mindset here to think about this, because it's just not a law enforcement problem. I mean, in the state of Texas, you have the Texas National Guard deployed on the border to help the Texas Rangers and the Texas Department of Public Safety engaged in trying to thwart drugs coming to the United States. But and yet we're only interdicting this amount. It just boggles the mind when you think about that. And then as you look at that, and why is it important to Washington, D.C.? Look at your murder rates in right. any major city around the country. And the bulk of that is drug-fueled, drug-induced,
That's right.
fighting over territory, fighting over turf, fighting over drugs, fighting over drug loads. That's why it's important.
Healthcare, education, you know, all the aspects of our economy are impacted by this drug usage. And, you know, I mean, and our society in terms of being a strong country, if everybody's drugged or you got, you know, different elements of a drug seeping in that have the impact on the mind of our young people or older people, whoever taking this stuff, it has an impact on so many facets. But the conversation does not seem to be taking hold in D.C. like it should. You know, we've had drug czars and other people like that, and I agree with you, Fred. I don't know what the full answer is, but it doesn't seem like there's been enough, you know, resources being dedicated to it.
Or a smarter way to use the resources that we already have
right.
in some sort of partnership with drug awareness programs, which are very effective if you can reach kids at a young enough age in the various communities that stretch across our great nation, which is part of the challenge. I mean, everybody wants to make it just a law enforcement problem / military now, when you think about the Coast Guard and the National Guard units deployed on this issue. But in reality, what headway are we really making?
That's right, Fred. It's a constant issue, and these issues seem to be growing. We're going to keep breast of these issues with you as we're going throughout the year. And we thank you for so much providing the insight that you're providing on the terror situation on Mexico and everything else that's going on. We've been talking to Fred Burton. He's the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. Fred mentioned that there's some great resources there. Mexico Report, they've got some other things out there that you can also read, the subscription services and everything else. But a great site to really keep abreast of what's going on with a number of different issues internationally and also right on our border. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.